regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company, a special Friday edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. We don't normally do this, but had to be off on Wednesday. Had to be off on Thursday because I didn't have a producer, but producer Jim is back today. And so we figured, yeah, why not? Why not do an extra show? We're going to be talking with Rob Dorr from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus here in just a moment or two about, frankly, a wide variety of subjects. So you've got the recent Minnesota State Supreme Court decision saying that the way the state's law against unserialized firearms was being enforced was wrong, which is good news for gun owners. Perhaps a short-lived decision because we do have Democrats who are already trying to tweak the state's statute regarding unserialized firearms. Also, taking a look at a friend of the court brief that Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus is involved in, and the broader issue of adults 18, 19, and 20 years old and their right to keep and bear arms, which is the subject of multiple lawsuits around the country and the subject of, frankly, court splits. You've got some appellate courts like the Eighth Circuit that have said, absolutely, 18, 19, and 20 year olds are adults. They have the same Second Amendment rights as adults who are 21 and older. And then you've got other courts like the 11th Circuit that have said, no, when it comes to owning a gun anyway, 18, 19, and 20 year olds, they're minors. I mean, they can serve on a jury, then get married. They can serve in the military. They can possess a firearm under federal law, but can't buy a handgun at retail. In fact, in some states like Florida, can't buy long guns either. So the Supreme Court is going to have the opportunity to weigh in on this issue before long, and actually had the opportunity to weigh in last term involving a case out of Minnesota that the Supreme Court actually rejected. This was a good rejection, though, unlike most of what we saw last year. This was in an appeal by Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison regarding that Eighth Circuit decision, which was favorable for gun owners and Second Amendment supporters. He asked the Supreme Court to step in and overturn that Eighth Circuit decision. The Supreme Court declined to do so, but that didn't resolve the circuit court split. So I think sooner or later we are going to see the court take one of these cases and hopefully do it. What I think they signaled in last year and declare definitively that, yes, 18, 19, and 20-year-olds do have the right to keep and bear arms. Anyway, that is one, as I said, of the many topics of conversation with Mr. Rob Dorr. Take a look and a listen. Rob, thanks very much for coming to the program. It's good to see you, my friend.
My pleasure, Cam. Always good to be with you.
It is great to have you guys with us. And the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus is awfully busy right now, both in terms of legislative stuff, in terms of legal stuff. Before we get to any of that, I got to ask, though, I haven't spoken to you since we saw the verdict in Nicole Mitchell's burglary trial. This is something that, you know, kind of played a big role in the last session, right? Because she was the tie-breaking vote in the Minnesota State Senate. The DFL kept her in place. They removed her from her committee assignments, but they allowed her to vote on bills that made it to the floor, saying that, you know, we're not even going to have this ethics investigation until after a trial has taken place. Well, the trial took place. She was found guilty. She's officially resigned by now, right?
Yeah, she has.
Okay. So what does this mean for the makeup of the state legislature going forward?
So that district is a pretty heavy lean DFL. That's our version of Democrats here because Minnesota has to be different. There is a special election that's called. It'll be held in November. There will be a new senator seated before the next legislative session starts. Likely to be a Democrat, but it is, you know, a potentially winnable, especially if there's some backlash, you know, that gets attributed to the party, particularly because they bent over backwards. You know, they would flap their gums in public about how she should resign, but then they stalled the ethics investigation because apparently they thought that they needed the criminal trial to happen to determine whether or not she acted ethically or not, which isn't a thing in Minnesota. But then also, every time there was a motion to try to unseat her, they would stall it, delay it, and have enough people vote it down. So all the same people who were out there flapping their gums so that they could have quotes to point to say, oh, I called for her resignation, did everything they could in their power to stop her from having any sort of legislative accountability.
Yeah, isn't that interesting how that works? All right, now speaking of accountability and legislative accountability, actually, this is pretty interesting. We've had the Minnesota State Supreme Court decision This is what last week, dealing with unserialized firearms, right? So you had a guy in Minnesota, and you're going to have to help me out with the background of this case, but he was arrested and charged with possessing an unserialized firearm. And the Minnesota State Supreme Court said, actually, the way the law is written, or at least the way the law was being enforced, doesn't jibe with what's actually in statute. Is that a fair understanding of what the Supreme Court said?
Yeah, absolutely. So the background is the guy got into a car accident, and when police officers were looking through the vehicle, they found a P80 polymer, you know, without a serial number, and they charged him. And this is one of many cases, including Walker Anderson, who we've talked about before, that people who privately manufactured their firearms were having this particular statute used against them. Particularly, some people who I've represented have had this statute used against them. And the way that the statute is worded is it's under a section called obliteration or removal of serial numbers. And so your brain goes to, okay, well, if I don't remove it or obliterate it or alter it, then I'm good to go. And then it lists out firearms that it is impermissible to have without a serial number. And it references the NFA. So the NFA, of course, means short-barreled rifles, short-barreled shotguns, machine guns, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But they were twisting this to just take one sentence out of context, out of the whole statute, and apply it to anybody who had any firearm without a serial number, despite Minnesota not having its own definition of serial number, not having anywhere where it could place. But most troubling, I think, to the justices, and probably what worked to our benefit, is when the Anoka County Attorney's Office argued this before the Supreme Court, they were asked very directly, does this apply to pre-1968 firearms that don't have a serial number? And the Anoka County Attorney says, yes, it doesn't matter whether they know they're breaking the law or not, they're breaking the law. And interestingly enough, our own DNR, which seizes firearms that are used in poaching or, you know, illegal hunting activities and things like that, routinely sells firearms without serial numbers because they were manufactured before 1968. And Justice Thiessen pointed that out in his opinion. So I think it was a lot of good things. Now, they didn't address anything about the constitutionality of the law. So it was a little bit different in that sense. They didn't say, no, it's unconstitutional, because that kind of ruling definitely wouldn't come from our Supreme Court. Right. But what they did was kind of a textual analysis and looked at it and said, no, this statute clearly only applies to firearms that are required to be registered at the federal level. And those are only, you know, manufactured firearms from a commercial manufacturer or NFA items. So if you're privately manufacturing it, or if it is a firearm that existed prior to the requirement to be serialized, that's sold by a manufacturer, you're good to own it and carry it in Minnesota.
Okay. I'm curious, is there even any way to serialize a firearm and register with the state of Minnesota?
Well, so, and that's interesting, because the Anoka County Attorney argued that, that they could just take it to a FFL and get it serialized. And it's like, no, that's not how that works.
Right.
There's something that says that if an FFL takes in a firearm that doesn't have a serial number and they're entering it into their books, they have to put in a serial number. But Minnesota law offers no guidance on where the serial number has to be, whether it has to be etched in at a certain depth, or if you could just take a marker and scribble in FU4473 on your PMF, and then you're good to go. And then that also just goes to just the complete lack of rational basis for this law. Because let's say I put together a firearm in my garage, and then I put in a serial number on there. All of a sudden, that gun turns up in a crime. What good does that serial number do? It does nothing. It doesn't trace you back to a dealer, a manufacturer, or anything. It's just my gun that was stolen from me, or somebody who criminally manufactured a gun but etched in a serial number just to be in compliance with this law.
Yeah.
It doesn't do any good public good. So Justice Thiessen hit on all of those points, and I thought he was spot on.
Absolutely. And I know, again, that we've already seen at least one DFL lawmaker say, all right, we're going to change this. We're going to pass a law that requires the serialization. So I'm sure that's something that the COG is going to be dealing with next session, right?
Yep, we'll be fighting it. And then it just comes back to that same rational basis is you're creating a felony charge for somebody who doesn't, you know, take a Sharpie to their Polymer 80 or their, you know, pre-68 antique firearm. To what public benefit? It literally serves no rational basis.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, again, this is as you say, this was not a constitutional ruling, or at least a ruling on the constitutionality of these laws. But I mean, honestly, you know, a win is a win, right?
Yeah.
And so a textual win counts just as much as if, you know, the state Supreme Court had said, yeah, this violates your right to keep bare arms, at least in the short term. Right now, again, you got to go back and fight that legislative battle. But as you say, you're going to get a good constitutional ruling for the makeup of this state Supreme Court, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, some people, they expect that you can throw a touchdown on every play. And if it's not a touchdown, it's not worth celebrating. But this is definitely a huge win, and it's worth celebrating that we were able to get this kind of a ruling. But also it gives us a good indication of if we are going to be taking laws up to the Minnesota Supreme Court, challenging them, how do we have to go about approaching that? Because obviously if we do a pure Bruin Second Amendment challenge, that's not likely to gain a lot of traction in Minnesota courts. But if we can go with a more textualist argument, the justices are at least tipping their hand that they're willing to entertain and uphold things that aren't in line with the statutory text.
And again, I mean, this has real world applications, right? You mentioned the case of Walker Anderson. The charges against him were dropped after this ruling, correct?
Yep. Yeah. And I've got several motions in for some of our clients. I work in public defense to address those. And we're going to be seeing them dropping like flies at this point. Now, I do still feel bad. There are people who who are on probation now that are going to have to go through resentencing. There are people who have had their firearms seized and destroyed that aren't likely to get compensation for those. They can try a 1983 claim, but how much money are you going to spend to try to, you know, to try to get compensation for, you know, $500 or $600 worth of parts?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And that is frustrating. So what are some of the other legal fights that y'all are involved in right now? Because, again, as I mentioned, you all are not just involved legislatively. You are very active in the courts, and not just in Minnesota.
Minnesota is a little bit weird where, you know, we are Minnesota nice, and typically we have one party in control of one body and the other party in control of the other body. And so not a whole lot gets done. We have had a couple of stints of complete DFL, Democrat leadership and control. But right now we're in this kind of divided legislature environment. We got kind of sick with that stalling. So we decided to shift over and devote more resources into doing more legal action. And so you'll see us writing amicus briefs and joining in with some allies across the country, filing suits here in Minnesota. Like we just won the 18 to 21 year old case at the Supreme Court, protecting those rights. But then also we're suing the state of Minnesota right now for sneaking in a, you know, 1,000 plus page bill, a ban on binary triggers, literally in the final minutes of the legislative session, without hearings, without a vote. Without like a roll call votes or anything like that. They just crammed it through in the final minutes of session. And we're suing them because that's not in line with Minnesota's single subject rule in our constitution, where every bill has to address one subject. This addressed taxing, agriculture, public safety, schools, all sorts of different things. We've had a couple of hearings on that, and I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get a favorable ruling coming up on that, and we'll be able to reverse the binary trigger ban, if not the whole unconstitutional omnibus bill itself.
That's fantastic. And once again, we were talking about, you know, the tactics that are used here, right? You're not saying, well, listen, bans on binary triggers violate the Second Amendment, even though they might very well violate the Second Amendment. But they do violate the single subject law, right? And when you attach them to an omnibus bill, that's the strongest legal argument. So that's the one you're making. Where is that then? Is that still at the, you know, lowest level of the courts?
Yeah, it's at the district court level right now. But I tell you, I've been in the been at the hearings, and the judge has been very skeptical of the state's position at every turn. So I'm getting cautiously optimistic. You know, you don't count your eggs before they hatch,
right?
But the We're kind of cursed here in Minnesota, where we've gone through over 20 years, two decades of Democrat appointed judges. So being able to find those judges that are, especially in Ramsey County, where we're suing, which is, you know, one of the bluest counties in the country, to be able to find those judges that are sympathetic to that, you have to make it the right argument. And I know it's really fun for people. They want to stand up on their soapbox and, you know, hold their rifle in the air and say, shall not be infringed. It doesn't work very well in court, particularly when you're before a more liberal leaning judge. So presumably, you know, it's a nonpartisan office, but you have to adjust your tactics to the battlefield that's in front of you. And that's something that we've been getting very good at here at the caucus.
Well, and I got to say too, I mean, just even from a non-segment member perspective, just from a good government perspective, holding governments to account and say, listen, you guys have to color within the lines. I'm all in favor of that. Yeah. So if there is a single subject rule, stick to the single subject rule. I'm glad that this is an issue with which you guys are able to litigate that it does touch on the Second Amendment. But, if there wasn't even a gun control component to this bill, I would hope that maybe some other organization would be challenging that, because I personally don't like it when governments overstep their bounds. Bad things happen when governments get away with that. So congratulations to you on that. And then, you know, I also I talked about the fact that you guys are involved in cases that aren't necessarily Minnesota based. You all are involved in an amicus brief. Now, I thought this is fascinating. This is another case where a public defender is representing a defendant who is charged with possession of an unregistered short-barreled rifle. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, I think this is out of the 11th Circuit, right?
Yes.
Or is this let me make sure. I think it is the 11th Circuit. But anyway, the appellate court basically didn't even bother to do any sort of historical analysis. It just said, well, you know, Miller said that short-barreled shotguns, you don't have a right to own those. They can be NFA items. So short-barreled rifles must be the same, right? That was essentially what they held and upheld this guy's conviction, basically taking these judicial shortcuts, right? Again, not coloring within the lines, not applying the Bruin test, but just sort of making assumptions that SBRs are not protected by the Second Amendment, and therefore you can put whatever qualifications you want in front of them.
Right. And I think, some courts are having a really hard time getting rid of the balancing test that Bruin specifically did away with. They've made it very clear that you can't balance it. Your analysis has to be a historical based analysis. And in both the Wolfgram and Robinson cases where we're doing amicus briefs on, they're just skipping those steps. They're just saying, well, hey, we found a modern equivalent or a semi-modern equivalent, and that should be good enough. And that's not what Bruin calls for. So we're happy to join that with the Second Amendment Foundation looking forward to some more, throwing more things up to SCOTUS to see what more we can get locked in.
Well, you talk about that. One of the cases you referenced earlier was Worth versus Jacobson, right? That was the ban on concealed carry for under 21s. Eighth Circuit said, yeah, that violates the Constitution. Keith Ellison, Minnesota's Attorney General, appealed that decision to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court turned away his appeal. So the Eighth Circuit decision stands, right? And people 18, 19, 20 years old, they can now apply for and obtain a concealed carry license in Minnesota, correct?
Yep. We've had a few hiccups along the way, a couple of sheriffs who didn't get the memo.
Okay.
Most of those calls have been very quick and very very cordial, that the sheriff just needed to update it. Somebody else, one of the sheriffs, said, well, we haven't received any guidance from our county attorney yet. And I was like, Do you need me to call him and tell him to give you guidance, or do you just want to follow the law that is right in front of you?
Yeah. But again, I mean, this is one of those cases that, we can build on, because there are a number of other under 21 cases, right? You've got the Paris versus Lara case out of Pennsylvania, NRA versus Glass out of Florida. I think both of those are actually heading to the Supreme Court. They both deal with the under 21 gun bans. We don't know if the court's going to take up this issue, but there is a circuit court split in part because of your efforts, right? Because the Eighth Circuit says, yes, 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, they do possess Second Amendment rights. The 11th Circuit says, no, 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, they're minors in the eyes of the law, at least when it comes to gun ownership. So it's up to the Supreme Court to reconcile that split. And, you know, again, I think because of the activism of gun owners and the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus, at least in part because of that activism, we do, I think, have the potential now for the Supreme Court to say, OK, this is something where we do need to step in and hopefully apply, you know, clear logic here that, yes, if 18 year olds can vote, if they can serve on a jury, if they can get married, if they can sign contracts, then
join the military.
If they can join the military, you know, that's the age of majority, even if it wasn't the age of majority back in 1791. And so, yes, 18, 19 and 20 year olds, they are fully vested with their Second Amendment rights. At least I hope that's the conclusion that the Supreme Court would reach if they take it. And the fact that they did not accept Ellison's appeal, maybe that's an indication that that's where the court is leaning anyway.
Yeah. I think you hit on a good point there that it's circuit splits are the kind of the fast track outside of emergency motions to get to the Supreme Court. And
maybe even a better, because they don't seem to like those emergency motions much, at least when it comes to Second Amendment issues.
Yeah, definitely not. That's a whole other episode. So we're happy that we're able to contribute that. We are working with some of our national partners. The Eighth Circuit does have a very high proportion of conservative appointed justices. So we are always looking for opportunities that we can do to help set good case law, and then help set circuit splits. Fighting against the ninth or the seventh or the 11th or whoever it may be, so that we can kind of get strike while the iron is hot with SCOTUS, as it was.
Yeah, I would throw in the Fourth Circuit too, which is the jurisdiction where I live, and we keep getting all these incredibly awful rulings, like, you know, Snope, that semi-auto bans are okay. We've got a couple of under 21 cases out of the Fourth Circuit as well. One out of Virginia, one out of West Virginia, where the Fourth Circuit once again said, no, you can do whatever you want to 18, 19, 20 year olds. They don't really have Second Amendment rights. So thank you for fighting the good fight there in the Eighth Circuit. And, you know, I guess if there's a silver lining for gun owners, maybe outside of the state of Minnesota, it's that you all are a blue state. You all are fighting to keep some of the most egregious gun laws off the books. But if they do get signed into law, then hopefully, again, you've got an appellate court that is going to be strongly respectful of the Second Amendment and not treat it as a second class right.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we are a blue state, but we've got a lot of strong hunting and sportsman's heritage here as well. And we're typically used, kind of us in Colorado are typically used as kind of the proving grounds for what can happen in, you know, in Midwest, in sportsmen like states. Now, Colorado's gone one way. We've been able to successfully keep the wolves at bay, so to speak, and prevent all of these really egregious things from happening here. And we'll continue to do so.
You guys are fighting the good fight. Oh, one last thing before we let you go. And this has nothing to do with legislation or litigation. Well, I guess it does, actually. So the University of Minnesota Law School has this gun control clinic, basically, right? I mean, this is basically free interns for Keith Ellison. They're helping to write briefs. They're doing research. It's run by a woman named Megan Walsh, who I think used to work for Everytown, right?
Yes.
And I thought this was really interesting. This is a interesting back and forth. So Megan Walsh was quoted in the Minneapolis Star Tribune about this unserialized firearms case that we just mentioned. And you guys, so the Minnesota Law School, blast this out here. So proud of the fact that Megan Walsh was quoted in the Star Tribune. You guys pointed out that she was wrong on this issue, right? And
she lost. Like she wrote an amicus brief in Vagle. Her and her law students wrote this amicus brief. It was terrible. Basically, words can mean whatever we want them to mean. And they lost. Like they were connected parties to this case by way of their amicus brief. And I'm sure that she very comprehensively worked with the Anoka County attorney to prep for arguments and prep for briefs. And of course, that doesn't get mentioned. But beyond that, the Minnesota law school has very stringent policies, as do most law schools, about what their professors can say within their official capacity. So here they are, like they're making a point to say that she did this in her personal capacity, but it wasn't. She wrote an amicus brief as a special assistant attorney general, and then had her, you know, her student henchman on there as well. So this wasn't in her personal capacity, and then they just gloss over the fact that she lost.
Yeah. And when you guys pointed it out, they took down the post on X, but they left it up on Blue Sky. I thought that was probably pretty interesting, right? I guess hoping for a friendly audience, but you all are on Blue Sky too. So you called them out there.
Yeah. I'm not sure what our social media team does, but they do a fantastic job.
They really do. Everybody, I think, at the caucus does a fantastic job of standing up for our Second Amendment rights. So, Rob, please give our best to the rest of the team there. Thank you for your time today, and I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thanks, Cam. I really appreciate you.
My thanks to Rob for joining me on the program. Looking forward to having him back again soon. All right, now let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll actually, I was going to say we'll stay there, but I think this might be a story out of St. Cloud, Florida, not St. Cloud, Minnesota. Where a former police officer has been sentenced to prison time for his role in a gun trafficking scheme. So why is this part of our recidivist report? I mean, well, A, it's not really a recidivist report because I think this is his first offense. But this does qualify as sort of the plea deal of the day, or at least the what the heck is the judge thinking sentence of the day. I've got no problem with this police officer being sentenced to prison, Michael Adrian Nieto. Sentenced to 3 years for dealing in firearms without a license, pleaded guilty back in February. According to the Justice Department, Nieto repeatedly purchased and resold firearms to multiple people, among them an individual named Ernesto Vasquez, who was described as a key member of a criminal conspiracy that smuggled hundreds of guns to the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and Haiti. Prosecutors say that Nieto used police databases to provide sensitive and confidential information to Vasquez. And he also bought at least 58 firearms between June 6th of 2022 and September 4th of 2024, admitting later to buying and reselling guns, including to Vasquez, despite knowing that Vasquez was then getting those guns to third parties outside the country. Nieto also admitted that Vasquez had provided him with illegal items, including a machine gun conversion device. Mm-hmm. Now, Vasquez pleaded guilty to conspiracy to traffic firearms and was sentenced to 11 years in federal prison. So my question is, why did Michael Adrian Nieto get 3 years after pleading guilty to essentially the same crime? Now, he was sentenced for dealing in firearms without a license as opposed to conspiracy to traffic firearms. But it's pretty clear he was part of that trafficking conspiracy, right? And in my opinion, the fact that Nieto was a member of law enforcement doesn't mean that he should get some slack. If anything, the law should come down harder on him. He was a law enforcement officer who was engaging in this gun trafficking scheme. He obtained illegal items from Nieto. And by the way, sounds again like he was sentenced solely for dealing in firearms without a license as opposed to illegal possession of a machine gun conversion device. Which by itself, I believe, is punishable by up to 10 years in federal prison. So that's my issue here. If Vasquez gets 11 years in prison, why does Nieto get, I won't call it a slap on the wrist. I mean, 3 years is 3 years behind bars. But again, it's almost a quarter of the sentence that Vasquez received. And to me, that just seems a little light, given the severity of the charges against him. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, also from Florida, where murder charges have been dropped against a woman in the fatal shooting of her boyfriend in Vero Beach after a judge dismissed a second-degree murder charges against her, basically ruling that the state had not overcome its burden in disproving that she acted in self-defense. In his ruling, Judge Robert Meadows said that LaVon Smith is, quote, immune from criminal prosecution through justifiable use of deadly force. And he noted that the state did not meet its burden by clear and convincing evidence to overcome the claim of self-defense based on the totality of the evidence. So Smith was released from jail on Wednesday night. Her attorney, Andrew Metcalf, told WPBF News yesterday that Judge Meadows was fair with his ruling, that the ruling was the correct decision, adding that Smith is relieved to be exonerated and is glad to be out of custody. Now, this incident happened last February, February 19th. Smith and her boyfriend, Jeffrey Simmons, got into a verbal argument, which apparently turned into a physical altercation at Smith's office, which was in the American Golf Club there in Vero Beach. According to police, Simmons allegedly unlocked the rear office door belonging to Smith and then began to go inside. The lights were off. Smith said that she told Simmons to stop because she had a gun. So apparently she had tried to get away from him. Went into her office. He then unlocks the door, goes in. She says, stop, I'm armed. She fires a shot. At that point, she said Simmons looked at her and said, you're going to be dead. And then proceeded to go towards her once again. Court documents say at that point, Smith fired a second round, striking Simmons and killing him. Medical examiner testified that Simmons' blood alcohol level was 0.195, which is more than twice the legal limit of 0.08. Also noted that Simmons had levels of cannabinoids and tested positive for amphetamines. Deputy for the Indian River County Sheriff's Office examined Smith, documented signs of bruises on her arms and upper thigh, and abrasion to her right knee. I have to say, now again, this is just one news story. I don't know the totality of the circumstances, but just reading that, I am a little confused as to why prosecutors move forward with murder charges against this woman to begin with. But it doesn't sound like, yeah, I mean, again, clearly the judge said, well, they didn't meet the clear and convincing evidence. And again, this wasn't beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what you have to show to prove a conviction. Clear and convincing evidence is the standard that you need to prove that someone was not acting in self-defense in order to move forward with these cases, to bring a case to a jury. And I agree with the judge. I mean, based just on that limited information, it doesn't sound like there was really any evidence that Smith was the aggressor, as opposed to the defendant, or that Smith was not in justifiable fear of her life when her boyfriend attacked her. So we'll see if we get any more details. I doubt we will. But again, this case determined to be self-defense by a judge, not a jury, and not the local prosecutor's office. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, not in Florida, but in the sportsman's paradise of Louisiana, where a fisherman saved a woman who jumped from the Causeway Bridge into Lake Pontchartrain outside of New Orleans. WWL TV reporting on this. This was Thursday morning. The Causeway general manager, Carlton Dufrichou, said the woman parked her vehicle in what's called a crossover, which I guess is where you could maybe, you know, go from one side of the bridge to the other, nearest the north side of the bridge. It was about 10 o'clock yesterday morning. She then jumped about 20 feet down into the lake. There was a fisherman nearby who reached her within minutes, was able to bring her to safety. St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office dispatched a water rescue boat, took her to the hospital. According to WWL, her identity, the reason why she jumped, not immediately known. We can make some assumptions about her reasoning and hope that she gets the help that she needs going forward. But in the right place at the right time, we'll be able to save a life. That anonymous Good Samaritan there with quite the catch here on Lake Pontchartrain. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Hope you have a fantastic weekend. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com. Both Saturday and Sunday, we're keeping you apprised on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information. We'll let you know Monday, there's a hearing in the California Senate on the Glock ban bill. So that bill is still making progress. We'll have more over the weekend at BearingArms.com and more next week on Bearing Arms Cam & Company about that particular piece of legislation. But again, thank you for being a part of the show today. Certainly do appreciate it. And we'll see you back here on Monday. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.